Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Fraudcast News. Well, it's a book by former Reuters journalist Patrick Chalmers that tells all about his experience working for Reuters. Also, Mohamed Makawi's here, another BCFM presenter, to talk about the shows he does and about Sudan. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Mohamed Makawi. Hi, Mohamed, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, hi, Tony.
Now, you do two programmes here on BCFM at the moment, as far as I know. Tell us how you first got involved in doing community radio.
I've been doing community programmes since like 2000. I start with the museum, which is the Commonwealth Museum.
Oh, right, that's Commonwealth FM.
FM,
yes, yeah. I had a go at that as well. That was good fun.
Yeah.
We did a programme about 9/11. And we actually won an award.
Yeah.
But anyway, what were you doing on the Commonwealth FM, and was that your first experience in radio?
It was, yeah, the first experience. Actually, the first experience is Barrett Radio Station, which is now it's online. It used to be called Bashan FM. That's about the late 1990s.
That was a pirate radio, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Passion. It was. Yeah, it was. But now they are online now.
Well, pirate radio, we have our very own Steve Satan here on BCFM, who actually worked on the medium wave pirate stations, which was set up in international waters to play pop music. Otherwise, you know, the BBC would have censored it. And, I mean, what we're doing in a way is what the BBC do quite a lot, is they have people on their programmes, don't they? Other BBC programmes on their programmes. But I like to think we're a bit different on BCFM because we have, a little bit more of a challenge attitude. In fact, one of the former chairmen of the BBC, Sir Christopher Bland, was a couple of weeks ago was just saying that he was very worried that the BBC was just becoming another arm of the government.
I think he's right, because the BBC is just a propaganda for the government, and we pay for that. As a license, fees bear, and they use it to propaganda.
The thing is that Rupert Murdoch would say it's unfair competition. The Murdoch Empire calls the BBC unfair competition. He says, "Well, hang on, they've got this massive website all paid for by the public. This is not fair competition." Mm-hmm.
In a way, even if I don't like him, but still, you know. He's right in saying that.
Well, I had the pleasure to share a car, must be going back 6-7 years now, with Louis Sherwood, who was a former master of the Merchant Venturers, actually really nice guy. And he was the chairman of HTV. Okay. And I mentioned the name of Rupert Murdoch in his car, and he nearly jammed the brakes on him. Didn't actually. He said, "Don't mention that man in my car, in my presence.
Yeah.
He's poison."
Yeah.
And this is coming from the people that used to run broadcasting in Britain. I mean, Louis was chairman of HTV through its really golden days.
You know why? Because all of them, they are like power struggle, you know, between the BBC, Murdoch, and, you know, the rest of them. And all, in the end of the day, they're doing the same job, which is all of us as in the media, we know, and even the public, they know.
Well, one of the biggest stories to affect the Middle East in the last few weeks has been the signing of this historic deal, isn't it, with the Iranians and Kerry. I mean, looking at this, it seems to me Obama is absolutely, you know, a lot of people criticise him, but he's determined that there's going to be at least some good deals done before he leaves office, and possibly the Republicans take over, which, I mean, God forbid.
I mean, what he's doing for his legacy. Even he's not that popular now in the United States of America, but around the world, he's doing a good did, which is going to stay for generation to come. Because, Iran has been under sanction for how long? Because of what? Because of the nuclear power they want to get. And how about Israel? So
Israelis are totally in denial about their nuclear weapons. I was looking at the figures, and it looks like anywhere between 80 and 150 nuclear weapons the Israelis have got, yet they never ever admit to it in public, which doesn't really make the world respect them if the world knows that they've got these nukes.
And they are the first one to oppose anything, being done. Like now, Netanyahu, he's the one, he came out and... He's the superpower, and the rest of Britain and the United States of America and France and all of them, they are in his place. You know, he's the one talking. And he, have you seen the defense secretary? The British defense secretary. What's his name?
Yes, Hammond, Philip Hammond.
Yeah, he's talking to him like. He's the one who got all the power and got all the say.
Well, there seems to be a lot of influence.
He's criticizing them.
Listen, there seems to be a lot of power and influence by the Israel lobby, both in Britain and America and in other countries.
I know.
Basically, you're talking about Labour friends of Israel, Conservative friends of Israel, Republican friends of Israel, Democrat friends of Israel. These various organisations are very influential in whether or not someone becomes an MP or a congressman or a senator or whatever.
Yes.
And it seems how the Israeli influence works around the world, in being very influential in the political parties and amongst our political representatives. But you can't stop what's happened. Kerry has managed to make this deal. The one thing I did notice, though, was the way the BBC covered it. And I actually recorded the BBC coverage on Tuesday, I think it was around about the 12th of July when the announcement was made, or the 14th of July, on Radio 5 Live, the big report they did that evening on their 5 Live broadcast. And I also recorded The World Tonight on Radio 4. About 10 minutes each, those reports were. Not a single mention of Israel nuclear weapons.
Never. And you will never hear it. Or they will never admit it or say anything about it.
So why is the BBC acting almost as if a mouthpiece for the Israeli government and the Israeli Defence Ministry?
Yeah, it's obvious, Tony. That's how we've been ruled since even before the First World War. And that's the way it's going to be. And if you against it, you know what's going to happen.
Well, you probably lose your job.
Not only your job, you might lose more than your job.
Anyway, so that for me was really interesting. I sat and listened carefully. Channel 4 News did mention it briefly. Because the thing is, you cannot report on the Iranian nuclear deal as an honest journalist and make no reference to Israel's nuclear weapons. Anyway, we're getting off on a bit of a sidetrack. But you're originally from Sudan, aren't you?
Which is
very close to, it's basically northeast Africa, roughly. And you're bordering onto Libya and Somalia, these really interesting countries, in Sudan itself. Give us a bit of a picture of what Sudan is like as a country, because for many of us, one country blends into another because you're right on the border of Libya, for example, which is now turned into there is no government.
But we are not border with Somalia. There is Ethiopia in between us. But Still, the tie is there. But we border, north-west Libya borders, because join with Egypt. So they are in the corner of the Sudan. Not long border, but still, and where is our problem is now in the west of Sudan? Darfur, you heard of it. There is a civil war going over there. And there is no government ruling, and Gaddafi, he used to support this rebel before he's been trouble.
Support the trouble?
Support the rebel, yeah.
The rebels?
In Darfur. And they fight with him before he's gone, and before he's been thrown away.
What effect has the chaos that's now in Libya had on that region?
Oh, big time, because the weapons It just flew all around that region, you know, to Sudan, to Mali, to Chad, to all around, even Egypt. So I blame the British and the French and the American, because they just bombard Libya, troubled the regime over there. Even it's a very bad regime, but you cannot just do it that way.
Because listen, you say a bad regime, but with Gaddafi, you've got to look at this, I think, to try and step back from it and look at it objectively. The Libyans had the lowest infant mortality rate anywhere in Africa. They also had very basic guaranteed things that all Libyans would have a home. You know, there was some really good basic services that Libya
could
provide.
But they are tyrant and they are dictators. I mean, him and Saddam and all. I was against them when they are in on power. But I don't like the way they've been thrown. Because, see now, what's happened to Libya and what's happened to Iraq. And that's not the way. And because the influence of the West of coming and doing their jobs, the dirty job, not a good job, and leave the country in a chaos.
It's interesting, isn't it? If you were to say if Putin was to be killed, as Gaddafi was, you know, he was basically killed by a mob.
Mm.
Russia would carry on almost the same because, you know, there is a whole structure behind. He's not, you know, just a dictatorship. There's a whole kind of structure behind it. Whereas Gaddafi, once he was gone, everything fell down like a house of cards.
But we have to understand something here. I mean, these countries, they never been ruled by a democratic government before. They always been under the suppress of a dictatorship.
So, but you're now here in Britain. Is Britain a democracy?
Democracy, in a way, they want to see it as a democracy, but it's not, because it's a police state. That's how I see it, and everybody who's really honest, he can say that about Britain, because I walk from here to my house and I know I've been watched. And even my calls, my internet, everything.
Well, hang on, how do you know you're being watched?
Because I know, because I'm a clever man. So I know what's going on around me. I'm not stupid, you know. They think we don't know. Everyone knows what's going on. But we don't care, because we are not a terrorist. Because it's the other way around anyway.
But look,
because
I mean, right across the
West.
If
you're watching somebody, that's their privacy. And you invade that. So who gave them the right to do so?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is one of the things that's been a consequence of things like the 7/7 London bombings,
yes,
which are very questionable. I mean, you know, their families still question them, even if the journalists in London don't. I certainly do, as to what really happened.
And where is the line between the privacy and not privacy?
Well, certainly there seems to be a slide towards a police state. I mean, these are some of the sorts of issues that you deal with on the United Nations show on a Wednesday afternoon. Tell us a bit about that, when it's on, and you know, the kind of things you talk about.
Wednesday 2-4. And we're talking about, all the issues as we are talking now and in Bristol and around the world. And because we see Bristol as a multi-culture city, and there is the citizens of Bristol that are from different parts of the world. So that's why we call it the United Nations. And listener or even presenter from BCFM want to contribute to the show, they are welcome, and they can contact, BCFM by any means of the contacts, and they can be part of the show.
Great. Well, for anyone listening who's thinking, well, hang on, I know somebody, or thinking for themselves, I've got something to contribute to this, whether you're from another part of the world, or whether you're brought up in Bristol,
or Wales,
or Scotland, you know, wherever. Yeah. How do people contact you, Mohammed?
They can contact the studio on 0117 955 3721, or they can send us an email studio at bcfmradio.com or text message, that means the studio as well, 60777. And that's
okay.
That's how
I, all right. Yeah. That's the best way. And what we'll do is we'll give those contact details at the end of the interview again and at the end of the show. What about the real United Nations? Well, I say that. The other United Nations in Geneva.
The organization.
In Geneva, yeah. Because there's a lot of controversy about them, aren't they? Are they effective?
No. They are never effective. And they are used by the superpower countries to suppress the rest of us. So that's what it is for.
So it's really just a tool of the big powers.
It is, yeah, it's a tool.
And hang on, because you've got the General Assembly of the UN, haven't you, which has got every single country represented there, each with one vote.
Yeah, but there is five other countries, which is a superpower, got the veto. So if they don't like, and America, they use the veto like they drinking water. So,
yeah, that's the Security Council. It seems to me a bit upside down that you've got the Security Council, that is the military, big military powers in charge. Mm. Underneath them, you've then got the sort of political powers, the effectively their ambassadors, aren't they, from each country to Geneva.
I don't differentiate between them, Tony, you know, because United Nations Security Council, all of them is one of the same, like we are sitting in this office and the next office and the office next to us, is all they doing the different jobs but in the same or under the same name, or because the United Nations is the name of the organization, after that the Security Council, and after that or behind them the rest of the organization.
Well, what
UNICEF
about things like
stuff,
the UNHCR, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, because they're doing some good work, surely. I mean, there's got to be some kind of dialogue on an international level.
They do. We don't deny that. You know, they do, but not enough.
What about, the legacy of colonialism? Because I think for many people, they were quite glad to see Britain divesting itself of its Commonwealth, its empire, after World War II in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. Less and less of these bits that used to be red on the map, the British Empire, actually being run from London. But there's a sort of new kind of colonialism that seems to have taken over from it.
Yeah. And there is a new order, yeah, something like
new
this.
World
yeah,
order.
Order, yeah. And I mean, just they make the name look fancy and look better, but that's what it is. Is I cannot pronounce it. You know,
colonial.
Yeah, yeah. They are coming back.
So what do people in Sudan, ordinary people in Sudan, make of Europe and Britain nowadays?
Actually, they like the British, but they hate the American.
It's funny, the same similar in South America. I noticed that as a British visitor to South America, they're saying, oh, we like you English, but you've really got to try harder to keep the Americans under control.
Yeah, it is. I mean, because what we get from, even when the British like colonized Sudan, it wasn't a bad, we had a war with each other and everything, but they developed the country at that time. And even some of the Sudanese, they said the British, they left early than they're supposed to. They are not left early because we had a parliament, even the British were there. And our leader at that time, they haven't done a deal with the British to leave, but they announced the independence from inside the parliament, which is something having been done in any other colony.
So you're almost saying that the British left before they were
finishing the
getting
work.
Unwelcome. Politely left.
Yeah.
Right, we don't want to outstay our welcome here.
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's...
Because, the British, they are polite. American, they don't leave until they... They yeah. have to live by themselves, you know, or if it's not profitable for them. And that's how they see it. Because now we can see in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan, for them, it's not that, it's not profitable, you know, nothing coming back to them. But in Iraq, they stay longer because they know, I mean, they went there for the oil.
What about heroin from and opium from Afghanistan?
And now they actually, I was watching the news here in the West last week. Actually, they growing the opium here in for medicine
in Ashton Vale.
Yeah,
around Long Ashton somewhere. Yeah,
for the medicine purposes.
So it's not just Afghans; it's kind of catching on this
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it's coming here too. the opium. Oh, it's a big trade and a big and good business.
Well, I mean, it's interesting looking at the history of the opium trade and the way, for example, that a lot of the Cutty Sark tea clipper in Greenwich in London, which you can go and see in dry dock, apparently the main stuff they brought back from the Orient was actually opium in the bottom of the boat. So it was mostly tea, and it was supposed to be a tea clipper, but they had a little secret stash of opium.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was the real value stuff they were trading in secretly.
Do you think, I mean, the Americans, they done what they went to do in Afghanistan, especially Afghanistan, because Iraq, they will go back. That's what I think.
Well, in Afghanistan, I think they were trying to do things like they were trying to divide the Chinese from the Russians. They were trying to be on the east flank of the Russians and divide and surround the Russians. Also, you know, getting heroin. That's one of the things that quite clearly has been a big bumper crop in Afghanistan since.
So they didn't went for Osama bin Laden or
Al-Qaeda
or Taliban.
Well, it was also nothing to do with bin Laden. But also, you know, they wanted to crush Islam. I think Islam is not just because Islam is sitting on oil. Mm. It's also because Islam is an ideological threat to the capitalist mentality, which is money, 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 everything. Where, you know, the Islamic people tend to be much more, should we say, spiritually conscious. So when they're making a decision about what to do, they're not just thinking, is it going to make me more money? They're also thinking, you know, let's think about the rights and wrongs and the morals of this. And that's much more ingrained in Islam, I think, than it is in Christianity nowadays. Mm. Even, you know, a lot of Christians will say, well, actually, you know, the moral side of it, we set slightly to one side, and they're drifting away from what the Bible says in quite a lot of ways. But Islam, no, they're people are very, very strong. And of course, many Muslims are from the part of the world where the Holy Land, where Judaism, Islam and Christianity all grew up. So they're a little bit closer to that culture.
So do you think the West create the extremists?
Oh, definitely. I think the Americans are behind ISIS. Mm. I think the British are behind it too. I mean, we created the Syrian rebels that then supposedly handed their weapons over to ISIS. This is very convenient. I think it's been proven now that the Turkish intelligence are working with ISIS, supplying them from Turkey. The Jordanians train these guys. You know,
and
these are all
US allies. I heard
just
now, before I came to the studio, the Russian intelligence as well involved.
Yeah, well, all intelligence services will want to have their people in ISIS. But, the question is, I mean, I think they could just turn ISIS off like that if they wanted to. There's a click of a switch because of all the money that they're getting from trading in drugs, which they've got drug factories, methamphetamine factories, things like that. They're trading in oil.
So who's benefiting from ISIS
Israelis. The Israelis are also looking after some ISIS soldiers in their hospitals. So, you know, this I think is just an attack on Syria Mark II in a different guise.
Do you think Iran is going to be strong after the lifting the sanctions from
possibly
them?
I hope so. I mean, the thing is, you know, I want to see Middle Eastern governments that are representing ordinary Middle Eastern peoples, just as I want to see British governments representing ordinary people here. I mean, we're the sixth richest country in the world in Britain, and yet we say we haven't got enough money for disabled people. Mm. And we're going to have to send people onto food banks. Well, this is just greed, isn't it? Mm. I mean, you know, once greed starts to take a hold of government, then you've got a very dangerous situation brewing.
But they said they are bankrupts.
Who? I mean,
the British. 20 million they want to, and they cut 12
million.
Well,
I'll tell you what
that.
You do. You nationalise the banks. Yeah, you say, you think you're bankrupt, we're going to take you over. And actually, that's what's needed, I think. You know, unless the government takes control of the financial system, what's the government there for? Unless your MP's standing up for the poor in your constituency and in your area against the banksters, and they are banksters. Many of these people are criminals. They're just too big to jail. And you know, unless your MPs are standing up to them, then what is the point of them even turning up for work?
Why in these days? I mean, I mean here in Britain, if you are lefty or you are so unwelcome and you're not going to be a leader or somebody who's, especially now we're seeing the debate about. The Labour Party.
Well, look, I mean, a lot of it is to do with the media, isn't it? Who controls and owns the media? I mean, we were talking earlier about the BBC having the Israeli nuclear weapons as a big taboo in the BBC. God knows why, but they do. You know, that's the same with the right and the left. I think actually what's really going on, really, really going on, is the people that own stuff are making lots and lots of money and having a life of Riley while other people suffer. They're actually rather afraid that someone is going to notice this injustice and a government is going to come and take their nice little monopoly off them. Mm. That's why they don't like the left, because the left thinks like this. Look, you know, let's push for social justice. Yeah, so
and that's why they want to crush them in Greece.
Well, the Greece is being put under the screws, isn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, your other show is a bit more light-hearted, isn't it? And much more music as well.
It's musical, yeah. It's
when is that on? Because I see you every Friday, don't
yeah,
I? At
Friday,
7 p.m.
7 to 10, and I do two culture music from Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, which is Arabic music and African music.
And it's called Arabian Nights.
It's called Arabian Nights and Salam Africa, yeah, two shows in one.
And so what kind of language do you have on there?
It's mainly English, but Arabic as well, you know. So, yeah, that's my mother tongue is Arabic, and that's what I speak. And in English as well. So, and the listeners like what we play, so they can call the studio and ask our delicate songs and just chat to us, you know.
So give us an idea of contemporary popular Arabic music,
especially the Egyptian more popular singer in the Arab world, and that's where it's like the Hollywood of the Arab, where is all the latest songs and all the studios, and you know, since the 40s and 30s and 50s it's been like that. And
what about a particular artist? Who's one of your favorites from Egypt?
From Egypt, a Nubian artist, his name, he called Muhammad Munir. And he's a good artist, and because he can sing in Arabic and he can sing in Nubian. And he's in like Aswan, you know Aswan Dam? He's in that area, and that's Aswan Dam. Actually, when they build the Aswan Dam, or they call it Nasser Dam or Nasser Lake, there is a city of in north of Sudan, mainly of the Nubian, being under the water of the lake, and there is so many history on that area. So he's from that area. So he's Sudanese Egyptian or Egyptian Sudanese. But we call them Nubian.
What's the text line number?
It's 60777.
Yeah. Or the email is studio@bcfmradio.com.
Yeah.
And the phone number into the studio is 0117-955-3721. And I think, Mohammed, your shows are on a Friday, the music,
Friday,
Arabian
seven,
Nights
seven
at 7.
Ten, yeah.
And on a Wednesday,
two till four, yeah,
is the United Nations. So the two shows. And let's leave now, I think, with a bit of music from Mohamed Manir.
Yeah, Mohamed Manir.
Mohamed Makawi, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you very much for you.
قالت لي بريدك يا ولد عمي بعدوك العسل سائل على فمي على مهلك علي ما بحمل الضمي على مهلك علي ده نحيت أبوي وأمي
I'm
That's Mohamed Munir there with a song called Fi'ishq El Banat. Now that's F-I, one word, I-S-K, another word, E-L-B-A-N-A-T.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Now the book's called Broadcast News. The author, Patrick Chalmers, and he's joining me on the line now from the continent. Whereabouts are you, Patrick?
I am in southwest France, about an hour south of Toulouse, towards the Pyrenees.
Sounds nice. Is it quite warm down there?
It's pretty warm today, yes.
And how far are you from the Med?
A couple of hours.
Oh,
by
lovely.
Car.
Sounds nice. Anyway, are you British originally?
I am British, yeah. That's right.
And how have you ended up down there in France? What's your trajectory? Because I know you were working as a journalist here in the UK.
Yeah, I was working actually not just in the UK. I was working in Brussels and out in Malaysia for a while in London. And I suppose as a journalist, I was in London, moved to Brussels as a freelance, and then joined Reuters there, the news agency, for a while. Back to London, covered financial markets with Reuters, went out to Malaysia with them for a few years, 3 years. After the financial crisis in Malaysia, that was 1997 or so, and then back to London. And when I negotiated a redundancy from Reuters in 2005, I moved with my family out to France.
What about working for these big news agencies? How did you find it?
Well, that's what the subject, I suppose, the thread of broadcast news is actually broadcast news rather than broadcast news, because it's criticizing the journalism industry as well as sort of politics in general. How I was working for big journalism, I, on the way in, thought of it as my dream job to go and become a foreign correspondent for someone like Reuters. And I gradually decided that it wasn't at all what I'd imagined it would be.
So why was that? I mean, it does sound like a dream job, doesn't it? You're going to all different parts of the world and also meeting some of the most interesting, rich and powerful people.
The motivation obviously wasn't just to go abroad or meet rich and powerful people. It was, I suppose it was my version of somehow or other contributing something to society. And I fancied doing that using journalism. So in my own tiny way, contributing to that. And as I got a bit more experienced with journalism, having, as most journalists, sort of battled my way to actually get into a salaried job, I found that it wasn't so much that. It was far more to do sort of pro forma news, which was pretty much supporting the status quo. It wasn't really looking under the rug a great deal. And it was, you know, parroting for and against positions on any number of different topics. And it wasn't really breaking any particular stories that were helping society move forward, which perhaps naively I was thinking was the job of a journalist.
Well, it sounds to me like you weren't really questioning things enough. Are there any stories that you covered where you thought, actually, no, I don't think we did a very good job on that?
Very much so. I think probably the thread through the book was climate change. I was hired by Reuters in 94, I think it was, in Brussels. And at the time, I was, amongst other things, their environment correspondent, covering what I suppose was the start of global negotiations on climate change. And I went to Kyoto to cover the big talks, the end of year global talks on climate change. There was at the time what seemed a very hopeful deal in which the rich countries in the world actually sounded as if they were going to do things. And then that rapidly unraveled. And as a journalist, what I felt is that we were doing a very poor job of covering the behind the scenes. So getting underneath why it was that the deal was unraveling, who was undermining the deal, who had benefited from the deal falling apart. And also the gathering question for me was the exact legitimacy of elected politicians to negotiate on things such as this. There's a huge power imbalance in global negotiations on climate change. The rich countries, by and large, created the problem, and yet they were blocking any sort of real fundamental solution.
Well, and you know what would be really frustrating is if you could see ways that things should be critiqued, but you weren't actually, there was no opportunity given for you to write about them. So at least now you've done the Broadcast News book. Sorry to get it wrong at the beginning. It's obviously
no
a play. It's a play on Broadcast News. But what lessons did you learn about these climate change talks that you have been able to relate in the book? You know, something, I suppose, to help people understand what was really going on.
I mean, obviously, climate change is horrendously complicated, and I'm adding another layer, which is a media analysis of climate change. The basic problem was that the coverage was very superficial. So you would have a sort of fight between the United States and the European Union, and then a fight between the rich countries and the poor countries. The poor countries wanted the rich countries to do more and to undertake bigger cuts in order to give them money to offset the damage that the rich countries had been responsible for. And we would do, as journalists, the sort of Punch and Judy fight over that. But we weren't really going into issues such as economic growth, which is still an idea that is pretty much unquestioned by mainstream, both mainstream politicians and mainstream journalists. If you look from an environmental perspective at economic growth, we live on a finite planet. Economic growth is an artificial construct of economists. It's not based in reality. Nature doesn't do compound growth over years and years like the economists say we need. Nature does cycles. You have like the cycle of the year. You have spring, summer, autumn, winter, and things grow and then fall back. They give fruit and then they rest. Economic growth is like cancer. It's like an epidemic, and you're asking for compound interest over years and years. And the scale of things now, we look at things on a global level, it's clear that that is no longer possible. And when I was at Reuters, and in fact, if were I still to be at Reuters and many other places as well, if you start questioning things like economic growth, they think you're some sort of lentil munching hippie. You know, you're sort of close to crazy and get back to your day job sort of thing.
Now, that sounds like groupthink that George Orwell wrote about in 1984. Are there any other areas you think that these big news wires, these big news agencies have groupthink on?
It's not just the news agencies, it's pretty much all mainstream journalism. If you look at the UK general election just passed, for example, it was an incredibly staged event. There was the campaign, which was very closely controlled by the main parties. And we have a result which has given us a majority government on the basis of about 25% of the eligible voting population who can not do pretty much everything they want, but they have a majority with which to govern. And the idea that going forward for the next 5 years, that government is treated as if it's a legitimate representation of UK public opinion is bordering on farcical, if you ask me, but it's treated as totally everyday run-of-the-mill by any number of the mainstream press and certainly the international news agencies as well. And what's true for the United Kingdom is true for any so-called representative democracy anywhere in the world. There is the theatre of election, and then there's the day-to-day decision-making, which the professionals do, and they do it way beyond the influence and without really any accountability to ordinary citizens. If you want to get journalists to write about that, it's that sort of, that's into polemic territory. That's what you're called. It's a lack of subjectivity, a lack of objectivity, I'm sorry. That's not what journalists do. But in fact, that's what ordinary people think, and ordinary people are bang on the money as far as that's concerned.
What about some of the other big stories like the Middle East, the Ukraine, Greece and their bailout at the moment? What do you think, there's some groupthink going on there too?
Very much so. In fact, groupthink is good that you talk about George Orwell, because George Orwell pretty much nailed it in 1984. That's obviously unfortunate in the sort of fictional novel, but it contains a great deal of truth. The likes of Noam Chomsky today is a US academic based in MIT. He writes about the problems of effectively media capture. Media are an arm of the status quo of elite thinking. So they don't really challenge the people who pay them. They don't really differ from the people they're reporting on. So if you look at any of those stories you've just talked about, whether it's Syria, the Middle East, whether it's Greece, for example, you are getting, by and large, the groupthink coverage of the issue. Greece, let's take for an example. Greece is not only, as I think we were exchanging on Facebook, what could kindly be called a fiscal waterboarding of the Greek people. It is also told in a very narrow corridor. There are all sorts of truths that link the Greek story back to the financial crisis of 2008, the massive bailout of private multinational banks at public expense, the bailout of French and German banks at the expense of the Greek people, the idea that no one in the 28-country European Union is really getting a chance to say anything about what's going on with the imposition of austerity, which in fact, as Paul Krugman, the US economist, has said, doesn't actually work anyway, but the imposition of austerity on the Greek people. So there's a total lack of democracy, which in terms of real popular accountability for what's going on in this whole Greek story. And that lack of accountability runs through pretty much everything. And yet it's not tackled by journalists generally. Journalists generally go to the press conference with the prime minister, with the opposition, maybe the CBI, maybe they got down to an ordinary person at the bottom of the story, or perhaps a union leader. But in terms of the accountability for what these people are doing in our so-called in our name, there's no getting beneath the skin of it. You get the odd standout journalist who does it, so they do exist. But by and large, the huge wave of day-to-day, wall-to-wall news is very much the status quo, which means that most people are not given the opportunity or don't even think to look beyond the headlines and look beyond the sort of the superficial blah, blah that they're offered through every channel they should possibly address or open up.
Now, you're painting a picture of a kind of media warfare with the public as the target. I mean, is that me exaggerating? And also, if that is the case, who's benefiting from all this?
Well, you can look at the last sort of 30 years or so in terms of wealth distribution. You could easily see how what the Occupy Wall Street and its various versions around the world have been calling the 1% versus the 99%. More accurately, it's more like the 0.1% versus the 99.9%. The disparity between that 0.1% and the rest of the planet has got massively worse over those last 30 years. So who's benefiting? Call it coincidence, call it the reality, call it the plan. Those people are definitely benefiting, and ordinary people, the squeezed middle and the poor, are definitely not benefiting.
Okay, so tell us, how is it easy enough to get hold of a copy of Broadcast News, not Broadcast News.
It is, yeah. First of all, it's about democracy. And as far as I'm concerned, democracy is an incredibly important subject. So I decided, because I decided also to publish the book myself, that if you want it and you don't want to pay for it, you can download a free PDF. So if you go to fraudcastnews.net and sort of look around some of the buttons there, you can download a free PDF copy for nothing and read it on a screen or print it off. You can look it up on your favorite online bookselling channel, and you can tap it in, Fraudcast News, and my name, Patrick Chalmers, and you'll get a copy. I would encourage people to go off the booksellers that sound like Brazilian rivers and go to independent booksellers if they can. If you go into a bookstore and order it, it has an ISBN number, so you can order it through your local bookshop as well.
Patrick, I suppose the final question has got to be, where is this all heading? Are we going to actually have some sort of revolution in media where they start actually telling the truth for the whole population rather than just the 1%?
It's a really good question, Tony. I actually think that there are quite a lot of what are called independent media out there nowadays. I look at sites like particularly Democracy Now!, which is a reader-funded site in the States, which publishes every weekday an hour-long broadcast. There's plenty of sort of lower key sites here and there, and you need to dig them out. So in a way, the cover is already being lifted, and the conventional news, under pressure of financial models, are having to shift a bit. But it's not going to be the conventional news organizations that are going to be the big change makers. Reuters is mainly paid for by banks and financial institutions. There is not going to be a fundamental examination of financial markets running or playing merry hell with the rest of the planet by Reuters, because it's not their job. They're not being paid to do that.
Okay, Patrick Chalmers, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined by Angela Balassi now. Hi, Angela. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony. Thank you.
Now, you've got a story this week, haven't you, from the local paper, the Bristol Post, is it?
That's correct.
And it's about benefits in the city.
Yes. With the 35,000 people in Bristol are likely to see a drop in their benefits with the government reforms to the welfare. And they're introducing universal credit under a programme of reform to save £12 billion nationally in public spending.
OK, 35,000, did you say?
That's correct.
Good God, that's quite a lot of people, isn't it? I mean, actually, that's 1 in 10 of the population, pretty much.
And they think you'll also have a knock-on effect when it comes to housing, social housing.
Now, what happens then if you don't have enough money for social housing?
Well, that's what they're reporting, is they're also going to make a cut of 1% a year to social housing, and they say some people will then struggle to pay their rent.
So this is, I mean, this is already going on quite a lot, isn't it? That that people are assessed for how much money they need in order to pay the bills, the rent, electricity, this kind of thing, the basic needs, that is, without actually having a life. You know, this is just to pay the bills. And so they're saying that they're not even going to pay that.
Well, it said an estimated 37 million annual black hole in last council rents will result, because an estimated 11,000 council tenants who currently receive housing benefit will eventually move to universal credit.
Right. So the universal credit is a payment which, I mean, it sounds to me like something from one of these sci-fi series like Blake 7 or something, you know, where you're looking at some kind of big overarching government system which allows you credits in order to survive. Actually, the problem with all of this, surely, is that it's actually really difficult to get work. I mean, I don't know about your experience, but people I know, it's not that they don't want to work, it's that there just simply aren't the jobs there.
Well, especially during a recession. And I suppose these reforms, as they're being called, it gives the impression that people, they're punishing people who don't want to work and rewarding what they call the working man.
Now, this is all really as a result of the crimes of the banksters. I call them the too big to jail. I mean, it's quite clear LIBOR fraud's been going on, foreign exchange fraud, these kinds of things. But how is this? Is there any sort of light at the end of the tunnel for benefit claimants in Bristol? Because quite clearly they're here to stay. We are here to stay. We claim benefits. We're going to have to keep doing it to survive.
Well, it seems that they're going to be introduced firstly, this universal credit will be introduced firstly to single, childless job seekers, and then it's expected to be expanded to couples and families by 2017. So it would appear that it's going to be increased rather than decreased.
Okay, well, just say no. Don't get nervous about this, folks. If you're out there claiming benefit, try and find out whether it's through Citizens Advice Bureau or through friends or elsewhere where you're actually claiming your benefit as to what's going on with universal credit, because it doesn't sound to me like this is going to work. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Patrick Chalmers, who's author of Fraudcast News, also BCFM's Mohammed Makawi, who you can hear on Wednesdays 2 till 4 in the afternoon, and Friday from 7 till 10. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko and to Angela Balassi. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Farewell to my family. It's now I must leave you. This far fatal shore in chains we shall see. Although we are taken, do not be mistaken. As brothers in union, we shall be free. They can bring down our wages, starve all our children. In chains they can bind us and steal all our land. They can mock our religion, from our families divide us, but they can't break the oath of a tall puddle man. To those who rule us, we are the dissenters. Do your duty, be thankful, don't complain, we are taught. For God in his wisdom divided this kingdom, for few to have much while so many have naught. They can bring down our wages, starve all our children. In chains they can bind us and steal all our land. They can mock our religion, from our families divide us, but they can't break the oath of a tall puddle man. As brothers together, with an oath we will bind us. The labouring man in all England shall rise. Though Frampton's defamed us, they never will tame us. Arise, men of Britain, we'll yet win the prize. They can bring down our wages, starve all our children. In chains they can bind us and steal all our land. They can mock our religion, from our families divide us, but they can't break the oath of a tall puddle man.